can also, even if the thing is, when the client sends its session ID, even the server is not obliged to use that in any way. Even though if it is valid and it did send it, it might have expired locally, or it may just not want to do it for some reason. There's no obligation on the side of the server to honor that. And the way that it, where it indicates that is by issuing a different or empty session ID back. If it issues the same session ID, then it's implicitly saying, yes, let's do accelerated handshake. Then the cipher suite, so it looks through the list that the client supplied, it looks through its own list, which might be ordered, and it picks one that's common. If there's none, if there are no common cipher suites, then the connection can't proceed. And then, of course, the compression method, which it's chosen from the list the client supplied, which will always be null. Okay, next, straight away, the server sends its certificate. In the case of RSA, which is what I'm focusing on, this would be just its RSA certificate encoded in ASM1. So it starts, here's a mistake. This is client, this should say server. It starts with its own certificate, and then after that it has the signature from the CA, and maybe the one above it, and the one above that, and so on until the end. Usually it's fairly shallow, usually only goes to a depth of one or two. Okay, then this message is not used very often, but this is used if the certificate does not contain the information that's going to be used for the key exchange. Because the certificate is not only, in the case of RSA, the certificate is not only used to identify the server, it's also used to encrypt a subsequent message sent by the client. Okay, so why wouldn't the client with the certificate, why wouldn't the certificate have enough information to allow you to do that? Well, there's a few different cases. I guess the most interesting one is ephemeral RSA, which basically is back in the days where we had to worry about export ciphers. Part of the regulation specifies that an export client may not use an RSA key of greater than 512 bits to encrypt a message. But having a 512-bit certificate on the server is not necessarily desirable. So they wanted to have a way to be able to have a stronger certificate but still comply with these export regulations. So in a nutshell, what happens is if you're using an export cipher suite, which incidentally you should never do, and the certificate is greater than 512 bytes long, then you generate a second set of RSA keys, which are just, you would generate these, say, at runtime, which are just used in the key exchange, and these are 512 bits long or shorter, and these are sent in this message. This message also used for Diffie-Hellman, but I don't really want to get into that too much. And this message is signed, so although what's inside it can be inspected by any other party, it can't be tampered with. Okay, and then last up, the server sends a hello done. So this basically means it's finished that little round of messaging. Now the client basically has to finish things off. It might send its certificate if it was asked for one, but it probably won't because it's not used very much. It might send a client's key exchange if it's trying to authenticate itself to prove that it is itself, but it probably won't because client authentication is not used very much. Sorry, I'm a little confused here. The certificate verifier is used to verify the certificate, obviously. The client key exchange is in the case where the server sends ephemeral keys. This is basically used to verify those. Again, that's not used so much either. So then last of all, you have the finished message. The finished message, as the name implies, comes right at the end. It's sent by both the client and the server. And basically includes a hash of all the messages that have been sent and received so far. And this hash also includes a label. So basically, you make this hash of your messages, they send it to your client, you make the hash, you put the label as client, you send it to the server, it regenerates that. If it matches, you know that no one's tampered with the connection in between. If it doesn't match, you terminate the connection. The reason for having the labels is basically so the two hashes are slightly different. If you didn't have the labels, then it would be possible for someone sitting in the middle just to reflect your finished message back to you, which is obviously not desirable. Okay. Oh, we're doing really well for time. This is awesome. Okay, so then that covers the handshake message, of which there's about 10 of. All the other messages are relatively simple and only have one variant. There's a change cipher spec, which, as I mentioned before, basically says, okay, all this stuff we've negotiated, it comes into effect now. Usually this is sent immediately before the finished message is sent. So that means that the finished message is the first message that's encrypted in our connection, or the first message that's encrypted with the new newly negotiated session. Then the alert, which is set when something goes bad, or if you want to close the connection. The reason there's a special message needed to close the connection is because in SSL v2, yes? Yes, the change cipher spec is sent by both parties. So as soon as you send it, anything else you send will come into effect. And as soon as you receive it, it's in effect. But it only affects one direction of the communication. So yes, it needs to be sent both ways to affect both directions. And when you implement SSL, you need to keep track of the state of the connection on a per-direction basis. Anyway, back to the alert. In SSL v2, the way you closed a connection was just by closing the underlying transport protocol, so basically closing the TCP connection. Now, the problem with this is if you can spoof a TCP fin message, which is not easy, but if you can, then you can do a truncation attack. And the problem with this doesn't lie in the strength or weakness of TCP. The problem lies in the difficulty in doing that is not at all related to this cryptographic session that's been negotiated to live on top of it. It generally is a lot easier to fake a fin packet than it would be to fake an SSL message anyway, but that's the problem. So alert messages basically come in two flavors. They can be fatal or warning. It's up to the whoever receives the message of what they want to do. If it's a fatal message, the connection's over. The other end is going to close down. If it's a warning message, they can choose to just ignore it, or they can choose to shut the connection. Okay, and the application data sitting on this page all by itself is the least interesting of all the messages because it has no structure. It's just the data you want to send, and then that gets packed into a record and encrypted. But it's also probably the most important message because that's how you can actually communicate what it is you want to say to the other party. So to give you an idea, when I did my little SSL implementation, I think it took maybe 2 months, 3 months to do the handshake and cipher spec messages, maybe a day to do the alert messages, and probably about 5 minutes to do the application data. Okay, I'm going to talk briefly about how the key is generated, and then I'm going to wrap up by basically demonstrating how a handshake occurs. Okay, so there's three pieces of information that go into producing the master secret. The client random and the server random, which we saw were sent in the client hello and server hello, and these are not secret at all. There's the pre-master secret, which is sent... I think I might have missed that message, but this is sent by the client encrypted with a server's key. So it's secret. So that it's a double-edged sword because it's encrypted so nobody else can see it, but the other purpose of this is if the server can't decrypt it, then it's not the owner of the key. So it not only transfers this secret information, it verifies that the server is who they say they are. And then the master secret is used to produce the key material, and it's chopped up into these little bits that we use in different parts of the protocol. And if any of these bits aren't needed for some reason, like for instance we're using RC4 so we don't need the input vector, then they're just left out. So how is this done? Well, I'm going to discuss it for TLS, not for SSL. SSL is similar, but it's sufficiently different that I would have to re-explain the whole thing. So it's similar conceptually, but at the implementation and the mathematics behind it, the equation is different. So that's really all you need to know about it. So the PRF is kind of important to TLS, and it's a nested hash function that allows you to produce as much output as you want. So this is actually used in the finished function, in which case it's used to produce 12 bytes of output. It's used for the pre-master secret, in which case it's used to produce 48 bytes of output. But you can produce as much as you need, or as little as you need. And it works a bit like this. Firstly, we start with an expansion function, which is a thing called PH. I'm sorry, I have a terrible cold. So this dot, dot, dot means run this as many times as you want. And H is the hashing function. And for both SSL and TLS, the hashing, it's used for both MD5 and SHA1. So you have this secret key. You have basically the result of the previous iteration. And you have your text. And you can see because SHA1 is 168 bits, or 20 bytes, if you want 20 bytes of output, you'd run this once for SHA1. If you want 48 bytes of output, you'd run it through SHA1 three times, and MD5 also three times, which will give you 60 bytes and 48 bytes of output, and you just truncate the bits you didn't need. So this equation's a bit nasty, but it's actually quite simple. So we take that. This is like stage one. We take that, and then we use this twice. So we do this, that previous equation, for both MD5 and for SHA1, and then we XOR them together, like so. And then finally, basically, we run the PRF, and we have the input of the secret input, which is this here. I forgot to mention, S1 and S2 is we take the secret and we just divide it in half. So like the opposite of concatenation. And then we use the PRF twice. We use it once to generate the master secret, and then we use the result of that to generate the key block. And the only real difference, apart from the fact that one's the input to the next, is that this label changes. And a different label is used for the finish message as well. So this just gives us our data. It's a bit massive, but that's the way it works. One thing I really don't understand about this, to be honest, is why there's so much flexibility on using different hashing algorithms and different encryption algorithms in different parts of the protocol. But in the PRF, we're hardwired to use MD5 and SHA1. I don't really understand why that was done. I'm sure it was for a very good reason. Like, if you don't do this, then you can do man in the middle and just change everything, something like that. Yes? Yes, these text labels are mandatory, and that what I have there is exactly how they are. For SSLv3, the labels are different. They're also mandated. They're just text strings. I'm not exactly sure what they're supposed to represent. Okay, so this is the last section of my talk. There'll be no more maths. I'm going to talk about three different handshake sequences that can occur. There are many. These are three of the most common ones. there are others. I didn't want to make this go on forever. So this is probably the most common case. This means you're using RSA. It means you're not using an export cipher, which you shouldn't do because it sucks. Oh, I should mention with the export ciphers, they do all sorts of nasty things at that key generation stage to make sure your keys are really weak. It's just nasty. Okay, so how does this look? We have the client host hello, which is basically gives the client random and some information on what cipher suite should be used. And we have the server hello, which supplies the server random and basically selects from the information given in the client hello. We have the certificate, which is, as the name implies, the RSA certificate. And the hello done, which basically means the server sent about as much as it was going to. Then we have the client key exchange, and the client key exchange is where we have the encrypted pre-master secret. So this message is encrypted with the key that was in this certificate over here. And then it's pretty much done. We send the change cipher spec, which says, hey, let's use what we've got so far. Let's encrypt. And then the finished, which means the handshake's all over. And then the server sends the same thing. And from then we just send application data backwards and forwards. So it's pretty straightforward. You notice there's a few round trips, slows things down. Decrypting this thing takes a while because it's RSA. But otherwise, it's pretty straightforward. Okay, so that's the most common case. I say non-ephemeral, but no one really calls it that because when you use RSA, you're not using ephemeral RSA. But I just kind of call it that to differentiate it. And here's the ephemeral variant. As I mentioned, this is primarily used if you're back in export cipher land with RSA or if you're using Diffie-Hellman. What's different about this? What's different is we send this server key exchange message here, which has... So before the certificate, in the previous slide, the certificate not only had the certificate, it also had the keys which were going to be used in the client key exchange. Here this is separated. The server key exchange includes the keys, and the certificate is just a certificate. And then, of course, we have the client key exchange. Basically, it supplies the keys. It basically uses the information in this server key exchange and sends the encrypted pre-master secret. So the only real difference is this message here and the keys that are being used in this message here. From there on, it's the same, and previously too. Okay, and lucky last, we have the resumed session handshake. And this is very important because this is the abbreviated handshake that's used to try and speed things up by avoiding the RSA operations. So basically what's going to happen here is the client hello is going to give the session ID, and the server is going to go, hey, I know about that, and send the same session ID back to the client. And then they don't need to do the whole key exchange thing anymore, because all they do is they dig out the master secret that they have in their cache. No, the pre-master secret they have in the cache. And then using that, the old pre-master secret and the new client random and server random, they regenerate the keying material. So this means that if you just happily randomly guess a valid server ID, it doesn't help you because unless you have the pre-master secret, you can't get anywhere. So for this reason, these session IDs are not particularly sensitive. It's important that they don't clash because otherwise it'd just be confusion, but they're not really vulnerable to attack. And then we have the finished, and from there on it's just like all the others. So it doesn't look like it's a lot shorter, but the important thing is that the bits that are missing are by far the slowest bits, and so it does actually make a huge difference to the speed of the handshake. wanted to mention one other thing, which is when we talk about the speed of the handshake, we're always talking about how expensive it is for the server to basically to decrypt this message here. And you might well say, well, what about the expense of the client encrypting it? And okay, sure, that's slow too, but the problem is that one server usually has many, many clients, so it has to do this work a lot more often than the client does. So that's you have 1,000 clients, you're having to do this really expensive operation 1,000 times, whereas your clients only have to do it once each. And so obviously they have, basically collectively, they have a lot more power, processing power than you do. Okay, that is pretty much it. If there's any questions, yes, Anand. It's not 1 or 2 seconds, it's much faster than that, but I would say it's probably something like 10 times faster in practice. Something like that. It's significant. Yes. So the pre-master secret is in. We're sending the pre. You're asking about sending the pre-master secret? Right. I guess the danger, yes, if you're going to be reusing the same pre-master secret, if the pre-master secret gets compromised, you're screwed. And you're going to be screwed for any connection that used that. But the pre-master secret isn't actually used directly. It's actually permuted into the master secret. And for different connections, you're actually using different server random and server client. So even though you know them, it's still not, you're not ending up with the same key. So even though the attacker knows what they are, they've still really got to get the pre-master secret. So I guess what it really boils down to is you shouldn't send more data than you're comfortable with the same pre-master secret, but it's not as bad as sending the same data with the same key, because the key does actually get regenerated. Yes. Yes, absolutely. The client can renegotiate at any time, sending the client hello. I'm not sure if the server's allowed to ignore it or not. I forget, but I do know if the server sends a hello request, the client is allowed to ignore it. Although the server may decide that it's upset then and wants to terminate the connection. So it's, the resumption thing is pretty straightforward. It's one of the reasons I didn't put it up. Okay, if there's any more questions, I'll be around here all week, so please come and talk to me. Thank you very much.
welcome to my talk. Thanks for coming, everybody. My name is Sean Burford, and I'm here to talk about some improvements in the Linux kernel, which will help prevent some common security flaws from being exploited and allow all of us to be a bit lazier with regards to our patching, perhaps. Or those of us who have to patch will be able to schedule our outages a bit more carefully than having to patch some vulnerabilities almost immediately. The way I discovered what I'm talking about today was that I was playing around with an exploit development competition, and I noticed that on my laptop, when I upgraded to Fedora Core, the exploits wouldn't work anymore. So I did a bit of hunting around and discovered what the problem was, and luckily enough it was easy enough to turn off the protection so I could continue with what I was working on. But I think the protections are interesting enough that a lot of people should hear a bit more about them. This particular stashed smack, smashed stack of plates is a piece of art by an artist named David Chalkley in the UK. I don't know if he's any good or not, but I like his interpretation of a smashed stack. Okay, so to find out how important it was having a bit of protection against these kinds of bugs that we're talking about, I went back over the last 5 years of Debian security advisories, and they don't have specific markings about whether it's a format string bug or what kind of bug it is. In some cases they do, but often they don't, so I cleaned them up a bit, and as such I've made up these stats to some degree. It's my interpretation of the advisories. But I think it's pretty reasonable to say that around about 40% of advisories are regarding a format string bug or a buffer overrun, and I've also counted the number of integer overflows which can lead to buffer overruns in the right situations. I won't go too much into the details of what a buffer overrun is or anything like that, because I think if you're here, you either pick it up as you go or you already know. And these protections, they really turn what used to be a one-shot exploit, you run it, you're in, into something that'll take a brute force effort, or it won't work at all. So it could take thousands of attempts, or it could never work. So for these exploits to work, there are some requirements. First of all, you need a bug. It's not like in the movies where you say, I want into this system, and you write up a pretty screensaver with a smiley face with a patch on its eye, and you're in. So there's a bit of code auditing at the start and things like that. Next, you need somewhere to put some hostile code, a way to get to that hostile code. Possibly your hostile code will need some arguments, especially if your hostile code happens to be the exec function in libc rather than something you've injected. And you need the program that you're exploiting to have the privileges to do whatever it is that your exploit requires. So let's look at what we can do to break these requirements. There's a number of ways we can break these requirements. They can either be in the kernel or in userland. The kernel ones are what we'll focus on. I'll touch briefly on the userland ones. But the kernel is most interesting because these are really bugs in libraries and functions that we've known since nearly day one of C. And most of the fixes so far have been fairly ineffectual library fixes. So if you recall on the previous slide, we had possibly had to inject some code into data areas, like a buffer overrun will often inject code into the processor's heap space, which is where you get memory when you do a malloc, or onto the stack, which is where you keep track of where you are in functions and local variables. So if those data areas can be non-executable, then that will prevent a lot of code injection attacks. This still doesn't protect us from returning into other hostile functions like exec in libc, which can let you run another program. And if you're a local user and you use exec to run another program instead of the normal flow of the program you're exploiting, then you can run something like a text editor or a shell inside, say, password, which you might have exploited. So marking data as non-executable is not the entire solution. Another part of the solution is to randomize the address space. With non-executable data segments and random address space, that means there's really nowhere for the attacker to go. He can't go to a function he knows about, and he can't go to a piece of data that happens to be code that he's injected into the process. A bit further on that, there's ASCII armoring, which we'll get onto. And finally, if all of these things fail, there are tools to limit the exposure when a successful exploit does get through. So this whole non-executable memory thing, this is really an accident of the Intel architecture. A lot of other CPUs have protections on their memory, so you can say this piece of memory contains data and shouldn't be executed. And really the only major CPU these days that's in widespread use that doesn't have this protection is the Intel architecture. Over the years, some people have developed workarounds for this. They're to do with the intricacies of the paging architecture on the Intel CPU. And there's really two ways of doing it. You can either segment your memory so that code and data goes in this part of this segment, but code goes in this segment and data goes in that segment. And then whenever a program attempts to access either segment, you go through a little part of the kernel that says, okay, what kind of access is this and should it be allowed based on whether it looks like an instruction access or a code access, a data access. Secondly, you can have a look whenever there's a paging request, a memory access, to see whether it looks like it's code or data, and stop it on the paging level. So instead of segmenting your memory into two halves, you can do it on a per page basis, which takes a little bit more time, but it gives you a finer grained control. Now on to address space randomization. If an attacker can't execute code that they've injected, and in fact non-executable areas have been around for years, and at first attackers thought, oh no, what are we going to do? But then they realised, hey, we'll just return into functions that are friendly to us. And that was how that was worked around. Address space randomization is fairly new. The implementations I'm going to be talking about have been around since 2000 for the earliest one. And it's not randomization of your data, it's just randomization of the layout of the libraries and the executable when they're loaded. Dynamic shared libraries, stack and heap, are all readily relocatable. The stack and the heap, there have never been any promises about where they live. And dynamic shared libraries are dynamic for the reason that they could be put anywhere. Code's another problem. When code is generated, typically it's generated to run from one specific memory location. There's two ways around this. First of all, you can mirror the code using some fairly complex virtual memory tricks to make it so that when the program attempts to access itself at the expected location, the kernel jumps in, checks whether it looks like an exploit, and if so, jumps off to the random location, which is not really a long-term solution. The reason for that is it adds a bit of overhead. It's messing around with the virtual memory in a way that it wasn't really designed for, and there are better ways. The better way is to make all of your programs just like dynamic libraries so that they can load anywhere. There is a bit of overhead to this because now instead of just assuming that this function is located here or that function is located there, you've got to actually look it up at runtime. But that's how these solutions are working, and this is where they're headed. On top of all of this, there's kernel exploits. There's no point in protecting user land if the kernel itself can be exploited. And one way around that is to randomize the stack on the kernel as well. This means that if you inject some code into the kernel and then do a buffer overrun and get control of where execution goes, you don't know where to send control because you don't know where your code is being put into the kernel. So that's really the same protection for the kernel as is being provided for user land now. Another little trick that's used by some of the programs is ASCII armoring. ASCII armoring works on the assumption that for some exploits to work, for example, if you're copying a big string into a buffer that can only take a little string, there are certain characters you can't use. The 00 character is one of them, X0, because that's used to terminate the string, so your buffer overflow will stop as soon as you try and use the 0, and the address has to be in the overflow that you're taking part in. So that gives us 16 meg of memory that we can put executables into that's harder to get to using an attack. And finally, should all of these bits and pieces fail, it's a good idea to use some mandatory access control so that even if the process is taken control of because we guessed where the libraries were or we used an information leak to find out where the libraries were and we jumped to a library and we managed to pass it an argument that runs our program, mandatory access control can stop it all at that point and stop the process from executing. So let's look at a couple of implementations. The first implementation that we'll look at is PAX. It's a patch which has been around since the year 2000. It's 300k large, and it's a great big patch that implements a whole bunch of these features. It's got no execute based on two different methods, the paging and the segmentation, although it leans more towards the segmentation, which divides the memory space into two halves, one for code, one for data. It also supports protection of memory pages as well as user pages, and it cripples the mprotect call so that you can't make your data segment executable and writable, and you can't make your code segment writable and executable, because then an attacker would just have to look for a program which is called mprotect to change its protections and exploit that. They use a special kind of executable, basically compiled with position-independent code like I described before. And they also use the virtual memory mirroring trick so that programs that don't have protection can be randomized as well. Like I said, the kernel is protected. It's got protected pages which can't be written to and executed. It's got stack randomization. I couldn't see any ASCII armoring protection in it. It doesn't have mandatory access control. That's separated into a separate project which we'll talk about in a minute. And it's got fairly fine-grained control on which features are enabled or disabled per executable. That fine-grained control is used, the way you control that is by markings on the individual executables, so if one doesn't work, then you've got to apply some markings to it. And in general, PAX has a break it first and then apply the labeling afterwards methodology. A more recent patch, which came out in 2003, and this one is about 50k, is ExecShield. ExecShield also implements no execute using a paging-based method. It doesn't restrict mprotect. The ExecShield guys did a bit of an audit of which programs use mprotect and how do they use them and which ones cripple the protection using mprotect, and then they went out and submitted patches to those applications instead. And another good thing about recent exec shields is that they support the vSyscall acceleration. When you're going from user land to kernel land, you've got to do what's called a system call or a syscall. And up until the Pentium 3, there was one way to do that, and that was via an interrupt. With the Pentium 4, they introduced a new instruction, and that instruction makes it about 3 times faster to get into the kernel from user land. Because that's not supported by CPUs before the Pentium 3, the kernel has implemented a vSyscall function, which basically on Pentium 3 and below goes int 80 up into the kernel interrupt, and on the Pentium 4 and above, it uses the new instruction. We'll actually see that during the examples. Exec shield does address space randomization. It doesn't randomize the kernel stack. It does do ASCII armoring, which is it's nice. It breaks some exploits even if you have the randomization turned off. It doesn't do mandatory access control. That's up to other projects. And has a less fine-grained amount of control over what happens in each binary, but you can turn it off on a per-binary basis using markings or running them under setarch. There's a proxies kernel exec shield where you can choose between 4 levels of protection, whether the stack's randomized, whether non-marked executables are randomized, things like that. Another big patch, which goes hand in hand with PAX, is the GR security patch. This one's 700K, which you can imagine is fairly large and difficult to check over if you want to verify it. But it does quite a lot. It does randomization of your TCP stack to prevent fingerprinting. It includes an ACL system, which you can use for mandatory access control. And it's got lots of auditing improvements and various bits and pieces like that. So what you might be thinking is, what's for tea? Or you might be thinking, how can I get away with installing these patches but not have to go to all of the trouble of applying a 700K patch plus 200K patch or a 50K patch in the other situation? And the way to do that is install one of the distributions that includes these things by default. If you're interested in having a really secure firewall box, then you can go for a specifically hardened distribution like Hardened Gentoo, which uses PAX, GR Security, SE Linux, and rule set based access control for its access control and mandatory access control. On rule set based access control for a moment, this was introduced shortly after SE Linux because SE Linux at the time was covered. Part of the SE Linux implementation was covered by a patent which was apparently freely usable. But that patent has since expired, and SE Linux uses the LSM security module framework, whereas RSBAC does not, as far as I can see. So that makes SE Linux slightly more desirable from my point of view. Yes? Sorry? Yeah? Okay, great. That point was that you have a choice of RSBAC or SE Linux when you set up Hardened Gentoo. Or GR Security. Yeah. The next one is Adamantix. It uses PAX, ProPlease, which is a canary-based stack protector, and RSBAC. And finally, you've got Red Hat Fedora Core and Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which use exec shield and security enhanced Linux from NSA. So chances are, if you've got a reasonably recent distribution of any of these, you're covered already. Yes? Sorry. Okay. Yeah, I was specifically thinking of exec shield in 3. Okay, so apart from the kernel, there are a few things you can do to give yourself another level of protection. The first one is the easiest, is to take the bugs out of the software that you're using. You can do, obviously it's not the easiest. You can use safer programming languages, use tools like Flaw Finder to audit your code, audit your memory usage, things like that. There are some projects which modify compilers and libraries so that they're safer to use. Immunix Stack Guard uses canaries on the stack, so whenever you're returning from a function, you check that the canary is still there and hasn't been overwritten during a buffer overflow. Format strings and heap overflows are not covered by that. And you can also harden libraries to make it more difficult to make mistakes. So Immunix AppArmor takes that approach. So using these technologies in combination, you can have a defense in depth kind of situation. It would be preferable to fix the bugs, but these will give you a bit of time between when a bug is found and when you can exploit it, and each situation where you exploit it will be different. You won't be able to use a one-shot exploit. You'll have to use brute force or leak out some information about the memory structures before you can exploit a particular program. And the nice thing about them is they're all automatic up to the point where you start applying mandatory access controls. So even the user who doesn't care gets a lot of protection just out of the box. Now let's have a look at what these patches do to your system. Okay, while I was playing around, I made a couple of tools for showing your memory map and everything else. In this directory, I've got level one of the exploit development competition that I was playing with. There's the authorship and stuff. So what's happening here is we're reading the environment. We get log name and safely copy the pointer to that. We get home from the environment and we safely copy the pointer to that. And then we get the page break environment variable and we use string copy to copy that into a buffer of fixed size. And that's where our buffer overflow comes from, because that's an unsafe operation. We haven't made sure the target buffer is big enough for the data that's coming into it. So I put together a little shellcode generator which you give a few arguments. That's it there. Page B is the page break variable. So you go generate some shellcode and the argument is 40 addresses. That address there is where the other environment variable is going into. And then shellcode says generate me 100 no operations and then some code to give me a shell. So let's run that. I don't think it'll work. I think my security level at the moment is protecting all binaries. Let's see. Okay, that says the current exec shield protection level is 2. And under this version of exec shield, a level of 2 will protect all executables using exec shield. So we'll run the exploit. And the first variable is set to 100 no operations and then some shellcode. The second variable is set to overflow the buffer using the address of the first variable, and we get a segmentation fault. Now turning off exec shield. So it's turned off now. run the exploit again, and it says, congratulations, you've got a shell. And that's what the shell code was designed to do. And let's have a quick look at the memory randomization and ASCII protection. Turning on protection again. So normally, this is just the memory map of the level out of proc, and we see that LD has loaded into address 26/2000. The binary is loaded into 0804/8000. Whoa, and we've tabbed across. And every time we run it, they're loaded into the same addresses. That vsyscall operation that I was talking about before, that's that FFFFD1000 down the bottom, and that page just contains a call to int AD on this machine. Now if we try a protected binary. Oh, and the way we protect our binaries, this is actually important if you want to protect code you're compiling yourself, is we go GCC minus pi for position independent executable, minus f pi so that the linker actually uses pi as well. Lev1.c. And now we've got a position independent executable. And each time we run that, we see that first of all of the code is loaded into addresses starting with 0. Or 0, 0, and each time we run it, we get a different set of addresses, which makes it a lot harder to exploit. You've just got to keep on running your exploit with the same address until eventually you get lucky, which can take a lot of packets and a lot of time. Okay, any questions? Probably running a bit ahead of time. Yeah. Are you talking about exploiting scripts or... Mm-hmm. The question was about exploiting interpreters of languages. Is that's correct? Yes, you can exploit some interpreters by changing the bytecode so that you trigger one of these kinds of bugs. And provided the interpreter is covered by this kind of protection, you'll be okay. And yes, the bytecode is data, so if you do an overrun that rather than take control of the program, you overwrite some data, then yes, you're not protected against that kind of thing. Yes. Any other questions? Okay, well, thanks for attending.